MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the politics of power and a possible solution to our power problem. Batteries?
There's parts of the grid where power fluctuations and brownouts are particularly problematic, and it can be cheaper to actually build a large battery that can store power during the nighttime and release it during the day.
The leader of the Democratic Party talks about why so many Americans can't name any of the 9 candidates running for president.
It won't happen, I don't think, till we move into our primary season and people really start to pay attention, and really probably till we have a nominee of the Democratic Party.
And American GIs in Afghanistan, Iraq face a pay cut?
These stories and more coming up here and now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. All of the cities affected by last week's massive blackout have had no problems so far today as demand for electricity ramped up at the start of a new work week. New York City appears largely back to normal today, as NPR's Margo Adler reports.
The nation's largest mass transit system was running smoothly this morning. As New Yorkers faced the morning rush, much of the trash had been collected. The biggest problem has been food spoilage, with grocery stores facing the loss of all meats and frozen foods. Hospitals said there was an increase in reports of diarrhea and related maladies, and the health department warned people to throw out all perishable goods that had spent more than 2 hours in temperatures above 40 degrees. Officials advised New Yorkers to still conserve energy, and New York's Mayor Michael Bloomberg called for an investigation into 3 interruptions of the 911 emergency response system that occurred during the blackout, one of them lasting almost 15 minutes. He said the city would put together a task force to assess what did we do right, what did we do wrong, and how could we have done things better. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
Journalism advocacy groups are calling for an investigation of the killing of a Reuters News Service cameraman in Iraq by a U.S. soldier. Mazen Dana was videotaping near a U.S.-run prison when he was shot. Army spokesman Colonel Guy Shields expressed regret over the killing.
We offer our condolences to the family and the co-workers. This is a tragic incident. It is under investigation, and we will do everything in our power to make sure things like this do not happen again.
Shields says soldiers mistook Dana's camera for a rocket-propelled grenade launcher. The groups Reporters Without Borders and the Committee to Protect Journalists are calling for a probe of the killing. A senior health official in France has resigned as the country's health minister, Jean-Francois Maté, acknowledged that as many as 5,000 people may have died there as a result of the heat wave in Europe. The director general of health has stepped down, but Maté is rejecting calls for his resignation from critics who say the government did not react quickly enough to the crisis. North Korea is again making demands to the U.S. ahead of multilateral talks on the communist government's nuclear program. NPR's Mike Schuster is following developments from Seoul.
They made the demands last week in a statement from the foreign ministry, and today they issued the same demands in a dispatch from the North Korean official news agency. Essentially, they say, again, they want a non-aggression treaty with the United States. They want the United States to normalize relations with North Korea, and they want the United States to stop impeding what they believe is North Korea's normal economic development. And under those circumstances, it is implied, these statements says, that North Korea will dismantle what it calls its nuclear deterrent, but only under those conditions.
NPR's Mike Schuster reporting. Wall Street, the Dow is up 86 points at 94.07. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have edged higher today. Analysts say an easing of bond yields has reassured investors who are growing increasingly nervous about rising interest rates short-circuiting any economic recovery. Oil service and retail stocks are among the major gainers today following last week's blackout. IBM has laid off 500 employees in Vermont today. Officials blame the job cuts on a continuing slide in microchip sales. From Vermont Public Radio, John Dillion reports.
Most of the job cuts affected the company's technology division, which makes and designs high-speed computer chips. Earlier this summer, IBM cut overtime for 2,400 workers. Before Monday's layoffs, IBM employed about 6,700 people at its sprawling manufacturing plant outside Burlington. Employees knew more bad news was coming. Still, it took many by surprise. Randy St. Amand worked at the plant for 26 years.
It hit me out of the blue. I wasn't prepared for it. I am angry at IBM, and I think rightfully so. I just don't see a rhyme or reason to it. I don't understand it.
The company also says about 3,000 workers will have to take a week without pay in September. For NPR News, I'm John Dillon in Colchester, Vermont.
Mexico is accusing the United States of serious violations of trade rules to protect American manufacturers of some steel products and cement from lower-priced Mexican rivals. The U.S. has rejected the charges. Checking Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has gained 86 points so far today at 9,407. Trading has been light. The Nasdaq Composite is up 25 at 1727. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young has the day off.
It's here and now.
Well, everything's working again, where millions late last week got a day off from work because of the blackout. In the U.S., officials aren't asking for any new energy conservation, a contrast with Canada, where in Ontario, the public's been asked to cut their electricity use by half. So will the powers that be in the U.S. change anything? There is an energy bill in Congress. The House and Senate each have a version, in fact. They've been trying to agree on what to do, in fact, about energy for years. We're joined now by Jacob Schlesinger of The Wall Street Journal.
Hi.
You know, after days now of talking about energy, when I flip on a switch and the light goes on, that energy is liable to come from a private company now, since deregulation became more a fact of life around the country about 10 years ago. But does the state tell that private company that supplies the industry how reliable that energy must be?
The state has some role. They have reliability councils around the country that are supposed to also be monitoring various aspects of reliability, like how much to make sure the equipment is upgraded, to make sure that there's sufficient communication between utilities. Part of the problem, at least the folks who follow this closely say, is that a lot of those reliability questions are voluntary right now. What they have been warning Congress for 4 years now is that this system worked well for the 30 years or so that it was in place because utilities were largely regulated. They were used to sharing information with each other. People who used to be cooperating are now competitors.
So how does Congress sort all that out? There are two bills floating around, one from the House, one from the Senate. How do they sort out this mess, or do you despair of them sorting out this mess through legislation?
The bills before Congress deal with a lot more than just the blackouts. These are bills that have been before Congress for 2 years. It's what they call comprehensive energy legislation. And one reason why they haven't passed is that there's a number of contentious issues, electricity being only one of them. One thing that President Bush has shown great skill at through his presidency is taking a crisis such as this blackout and using it to enact a broader agenda. And his tax cuts are a great example of that. So one way is to use this crisis as a spark to try and get a broader energy agenda through, which would address some of these other issues as well. The fear, however, is that there are so many controversial issues that aren't related, such as drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that you can't tie those together. And the way to get legislation through is to drop all the non-controversial, non-related electricity things and deal with the simple fixes. And there are some simple fixes.
Can you give me a quick squib on what they are?
Well, the main simple fix, I think, is to give the Reliability Council more of a force of enforcement. I think it's a good bet that blackouts would be less likely, and certainly cascading blackouts less likely, if there was someone, a more effective cop on the beat. I think everyone agrees that there needs to be more investment in modernizing and upgrading equipment. There is some controversy about the ways that you go about doing that, whether the answer is deregulation, more market-based rates to provide incentives, or whether you want the government to play a role in subsidizing or actually paying for the equipment.
What about Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham's suggestion that the federal government now establish standards for reliability for all the states?
That is a proposal that a lot of people agree with. What's interesting is that there are a number of states and a number of regions and a number of influential regional utilities who are not in favor of that. The Southeast in particular jealously guards its protection of its regional control.
Jake, there's no near-term fix for this, is there? We are going to face the possibility of blackouts for some time.
Clearly, what happened last week shows that the system is vulnerable, not to mention the fact that although they have ruled out terrorism in this case, as everyone is pointing out, this certainly shows terrorists that there's an easy and tempting target out there. On the other hand, people have been warning about this problem for a long time, and this is the first blackout that we've had since 1996.
Jacob Schlesinger, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jacob Schlesinger is covering the blackout story for The Wall Street Journal.
Updating the electricity grid is a political but also a technological problem. And as Washington struggles to decide who will pay, how much, and for what, much of the technology needed to update our aging power system already exists, everything from giant batteries to high-tech switching stations. David Talbot is a senior editor with the MIT magazine Technology Review. Hi, David.
Hello, Gail.
So tell us about this. You've been writing about in your magazine about the aging power system for a long time now, so I take it you weren't all that surprised by the failure of the system last week.
Well, I don't think anybody was surprised. The warnings have been out there for many years, and what you have is pretty much still a dumb network, and smarter controls could reroute power far more nimbly than is done today.
Maybe we should define what you mean by smarter controls.
Well, these would be electronic switches that would automatically sense a surge or a sag in the power and correct it on the fly. These kinds of technologies do exist in a few places, but when we hear about a few guys in Ohio struggling for as much as an hour with a couple of downed lines, and apparently nobody else in the Northeast knew that this problem was developing, you can kind of quickly grasp that if you had smarter controls that could flip a switch on the fly, certainly could send alarms around the system, this would be a far preferable alternative than just a few people struggling on their own and nobody knows about it.
And I understand there's already one station in upstate New York near Marcy, small town, that's a good example of this?
Well, that's an example of a switching station that is a power line that runs from Canada down to New York City that when it's overloaded, these smart switches can automatically reroute the power through an alternative line in the Catskills. And that's a microcosm of what the entire grid could benefit from, in addition to more storage facilities and more people generating their own power with fuel cells and gas turbines that would relieve pressure on the grid in the first place.
And let's take a moment to look at some of the other specific technologies. Giant batteries. Explain that one for us.
Well, there's parts of the grid where power fluctuations and brownouts are particularly problematic, and it can be cheaper to actually build, in essence, a large battery that can store power during the nighttime and release it during the day. And there's a plant like that in Mississippi where they're doing just that.
But how big a battery is this?
Well, it's two huge tanks of electrolytes. And they're enough to power an Air Force base and the town of Columbus, Mississippi.
In terms of storing electricity, though, isn't there intrinsically an energy loss, as I recall from physics a long time ago?
You're right. And the thing to keep in mind is the grid does not store electricity at all right now. And you're right. You lose some efficiency in storing it and then releasing it. It's still a lot cheaper to do that than to turn power plants off at night and build out your system so that you have enough to supply peak demand during the day, which means you, in essence, have an overcapacity because you have to have enough to provide during those peak times. If you have some storage that can take power during the nighttime, that greatly reduces your need to build those new power plants, which is a huge savings, in addition to reducing your need to build new transmission lines.
Well, and speaking of money, any idea as to how much this is all going to cost?
Well, it will cost billions of dollars to retrofit the grid with these kinds of controls, storage, and electronic switches that we've been discussing. But the utility-funded consortium called Electric Power Research Institute estimates that the brownouts, voltage fluctuations, and, yes, blackouts cost the economy $100 billion a year from not doing these things. So you have to weigh those costs against what it's going to cost to fix it.
All right. David, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
David Talbot is a senior editor with the MIT magazine Technology Review. Relative calm is returning to Liberia's capital of Monrovia for the first time in weeks. Shops and markets are open again. Refugees are out looking for food and some way of paying for it. Negotiators hope to wrap up a power-sharing agreement later today between the government and two rebel groups. Meantime, the U.S. could have gone into Liberia weeks ago to stop the fighting and allow delivery of emergency aid. But a report from American military specialists who made that recommendation was apparently spiked by the Pentagon before it reached the president. That story comes from the Los Angeles Times this weekend. Reporter Maggie Farley joins us now on the line from New York. Hello, Maggie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What did this original report recommend that the U.S. do to stop the violence there?
Well, it was a report by what's called a humanitarian assessment survey team, which is a group of military specialists that go into conflict situations to see whether military intervention is doable and at what level. And in this case, the expert said it's not only doable, but it's necessarily immediately. They recommended sending in about 2,300 troops right away to stem the mounting humanitarian crisis and to stop the fighting.
But this never made it to the president.
No, it's not exactly what DOD wanted to hear. At that time, their policy was that they wanted to push the West African leaders to take the lead. They didn't want to get engaged in Africa. They've been sort of haunted by the failure of the Somalia mission in 1983 when 18 Rangers were killed. And at a time when they've got lots of troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, they felt a little bit overextended.
But you have to wonder, why send an assessment team in if you aren't going to listen to them?
Officials I talked to said if the president didn't want to hear them, he wouldn't have sent them in. But defense officials said they really exceeded their mandate. It wasn't their job to make a political decision to go or not go. They were just there to see whether it was possible to do it. So when the report came in, they squashed it. They told them to go back, do it again, don't tell anybody they'd submitted the first report. And the second report came back much less specific, much less forceful, with no troop recommendations, and a crucial and or that added ambiguity to whether or not it should be the U.S. to go in or West African forces.
And were people concerned about the specifics of this case, of this information not making its way all the way to the top, or with the strategic implications of what it was saying and how that was being assessed and whether it was correct or not?
Well, the State Department welcomed the Pentagon report, which buttressed its own recommendations to go in quickly to stem a humanitarian crisis. But the interesting thing about this is that officials in all the departments were surprised by the recall of the report and the fact that their authors were supposed to deny having submitted it. What's really at issue is what the decision makers, what kind of information the decision makers are presented with to make their decisions. I think it comes at a time when the White House wants to distance itself from charges it manipulated information to justify going into Iraq. And the recall of this report makes it seem like the Pentagon was being self-interestedly selective about information to stay out of Liberia.
And what were the consequences of waiting to go in?
If they'd gone in earlier, say, aid officials and Liberians who were stacking their family members' dead bodies outside the American embassy down there trying to make a point, they could have secured the port, which would have allowed much quicker delivery of humanitarian aid. And just their presence is symbolic and powerful, and people have argued that that could have stopped the fighting.
In fact, as you reported, there were at least 1,000 people who were killed in the meantime.
That's right, both soldiers and civilians who were caught up in the fighting or died from illnesses related to the war.
Well, Maggie, we'll be watching as you will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maggie Farley is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She joined us from New York.
Just ahead, talking taxes, terrorism, and name recognition with the man whose job it is to get a Democrat in the White House.
And later in the program, rebuilding Iraq when saboteurs are at work.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Making plans for next summer? Political strategists certainly are. Next July, Democrats will hold their presidential nominating convention in Boston, followed a month later by Republicans, who will name their candidate in New York. Since the Democrats will go first next summer, we thought we'd give them first crack this summer at outlining their agenda leading up to the election. So today we talk with the man leading Democrats in their bid to retake the White House. Joining us on the line from Washington is the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Terry McAuliffe. And welcome, Terry.
Bill, great to be with you.
Thanks, Terry. What's the Democratic message?
Jobs. Elect the Democrats. You're going to get the economy moving again. You're going to bring the deficit down. You're going to create jobs. You're going to have a prescription drug benefit. You're going to have a real education policy that's, you know, more teachers, better school modernization, and we're going to get people working again.
Well, you know, Terry, you don't need polls to know. You just need to speak to somebody you meet on a bus that an
right.
awful lot of Americans do feel insecure about their jobs, their health care,
right.
Educating their kids. But do you buy what some say, that so far the Democratic candidates have raised these issues but not provided compelling, persuasive solutions?
No, and I disagree. And in fairness to these nine candidates, Bill, who are out there traveling across the country, they are all talking about what their positive agenda is. Now, unfortunately for them, not a lot of people are paying attention today. And secondly, you know, they're not getting any coverage. It won't happen, I don't think, till we move into our primary season and people really start to pay attention, and really probably till we have a nominee of the Democratic Party. I saw a poll the other day that 60% of Americans could not name one of our Democratic candidates.
Yeah, whoops.
Yeah, well, you know, it's early. Bill
sure.
Clinton got in October, 2% name ID. You remember we went through the entire spring of 1992. Remember where we were? We were in third place. We came roaring out of a convention. Clinton won in 92. He won again in 96.
Yeah, but, you know, the president in a recent Zogby poll,
right.
for example, does very well on protecting us from terror.
Well, in that same poll, I do remind you, Bill, that the Bush reelect number in that Zogby poll was 43%. He is 15 points lower than where his father was on this exact day in 1991.
Mm. Yeah, his numbers have basically slid back to where they were before 9/11.
Right. But he's in much worse shape than his father. We beat his father, and his father did not have a soldier a day being killed in Iraq.
But don't you have to give me a paragraph, even now, from a Democratic perspective as to how you put people back to work? It's not good enough to just say it's terrible that so many are out of work.
Well, Bill, I just want you to understand the role I'm as chairman of the party. I have to be totally neutral. And we have nine candidates with varying degrees of for the Bush, parts of the Bush tax cut, for getting rid of all of the Bush tax cut. We are for tax cuts. I'll tell you, the Democrats are. We're for targeted tax cuts. I mean, there are things that we do agree on health care policy, you know, that people need to benefit, and we're for not having gigantic deficits of what we have out there today. So that's what you have primaries for, because we have nine people competing with different ways of getting it going. Someone will break through.
Are you going to be anticipating a rough campaign, possibly an ugly campaign? And if it does get rough, are you worried that you know, again, you're up against a guy that some Americans see, particularly for that 9/11 period, as something of a father figure, if you will, that to be against George Bush and against what we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan, to criticize it even, can seem unpatriotic.
I could not disagree more, Bill. I don't think people are looking at this guy as a father figure. The reason why he has a 42% reelect number today is that people think that he has abandoned the American people and he's not out there fighting to help them with education, with health care, with job creation. This is going to be a very tough campaign. But this election is going to be about choices. Do you want to continue to go the way of the Bush administration, or do you want new Democratic leadership? And part of that is explaining to the American public what has happened of the 3 or 4 years of the Bush administration. So you may call it all ugly, you may call it negative. Unfortunately for Americans, that's the Bush economic record. It is ugly. It is negative.
There are nine candidates, Terry. They'll be criticizing each other. You say it will be a very rough and tumble national election. How concerned are you that these candidates could end up leaving so much scar tissue on each other that nobody looks good?
We are a huge party, Bill. We are unlike the Republican Party, very monolithic in their thinking. We are a very broad, diverse party, but that's the genius of our party. That's what makes us the Democratic Party. We are a true melting pot here in America. I think it's great we have nine candidates. We may have one more. Wesley Clark may get in. Who knows? But you know what? The more the merrier. If they have all these candidates traveling America, talking about the differences between Democrats and the Bush administration and what they want to do going forward, I think is excellent for our party. The key is going to be, you're right, we need to make sure that we all come together, which I think will be sometime around the second week of March, all unified around one candidate. We then have 8 months to go one-on-one against George Bush.
Terry, how do you like your chances now as compared to, let's say, a year ago? I'm sure you're going to say that you like them better, but how much better and how come?
Well, I think over the course of the last month or 2 months, I think you've seen a sea change. I've said this consistently in the last couple of weeks that I've been traveling. As you know, I'm on the road 6 days a week, sometimes two, three cities a day, traveling all over. I think you have seen a whole change in attitude. I think you see such a vigor. This will be my seventh presidential campaign. And in the past, Democrats have rallied together. I mean, clearly I remember with Ronald Reagan, it brought a lot of people out. But I have never, Bill, honestly seen the real anger out there at policies of this Bush administration. I've never seen it before, ever before in any campaign I've worked on. And I think people are really excited. I know that a year ago people said, well, how are you going to beat a president 80-90%? Well, I've been there, seen it done before. But now with his reelect numbers in five polls in the last 3 weeks that have his reelect in the mid to low 40s, I think people are very excited. Listen, as I say, we have nine candidates who stepped up to the plate to run.
Terry McAuliffe, thanks so much for talking to us. Terry McAuliffe is chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Next week, we'll talk with the chairman of the Republican National Committee.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, advances in computer translation and robotics. We'll explore why sometimes software works better when it stops following the rules.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, how can anything move forward in Iraq if sabotage of oil pipelines and water mains is so seemingly easy?
Also, an editor with the Army Times takes issue with pay cuts to troops in combat zones.
And transcribing classical pieces for other instruments, even banjos. Our classical music critic offers her do's and don'ts.
Fundamentally, it has to be an arrangement that reflects the respect and love and admiration of the arranger for the original piece.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dave Faniff. U.S. soldiers killed a Reuters cameraman in Iraq. Lotus Navarro reports from Baghdad.
The U.S. Army says it shot at Reuters cameraman Mazen Dana because soldiers in nearby tanks mistook his camera for a rocket-propelled grenade launcher. Dana, 41, was filming the aftermath of a mortar attack on Abu Ghraib prison near Baghdad, which left six prisoners dead and dozens more injured. He was married with four children.
At least two press advocacy groups are demanding a full investigation. The first rush hour since last week's blackout has gone smoothly in New York City. Officials report no major transit or traffic problems this morning, but utility officials warn they're still stabilizing the system. Meantime, Mayor Michael Bloomberg says the big blackout won't be a budget buster for his city.
Everything back to normal for an August Monday. Weather's good, cool, sunny. Probably everything will be fine from now on, and we just have to make sure that we learn from this.
Bloomberg spoke on NBC's Today show. Millions of people in Michigan are still being told to boil water before using it because of the blackout. A formal investigation of Thursday's blackout has been launched. Officials are looking at the records of utility and power line companies to figure out what went wrong. The boil water order means bottled water in Michigan is in short supply. Some Detroit area supermarkets are completely out of bottled water as officials are trying to bring more into the state. The FBI is helping police in West Virginia determine if there is a sniper at work, similar to the one that terrorized the Washington, D.C. area. Three recent shooting deaths have occurred outside gas stations or convenience stores in Charleston, West Virginia. Officials say some witnesses have reported seeing a dark pickup truck with an extended cab. Police have been stopping trucks that meet that description. American Civil Liberties Union is trying to delay the California recall election. ACLU is presenting arguments in federal court in Los Angeles today. Meanwhile, top candidates from both parties are accusing the others in their own party of trying to undermine their campaigns. California's Democratic lieutenant governor is accusing aides to Governor Gray Davis of trying to derail his campaign to be the Democratic candidate if Davis is recalled, a charge denied by the Davis camp. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are ahead. The Dow is up nearly 90 points at 94.11. The Nasdaq is ahead 27 at 17.29. The S&P 500 is up 8 points at 998. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A new spate of attacks suggests that the people who don't want U.S. soldiers and diplomats in Iraq may be shifting tactics. Over the weekend, a major oil pipeline that runs north to Turkey suffered two explosions, at least one believed to be sabotage. Another strike on a water main in Baghdad created a temporary lake that delighted children in the heat of the day but cut off people's water. Both attacks, not on persons, but on the Iraqi infrastructure. And so, a question. How can anything move forward in Iraq if basics like keeping oil and water flowing are so vulnerable? We want to pose this question and a few others to Anthony Shadid, correspondent for The Washington Post, who joins us via sat phone from Baghdad. And welcome, Anthony.
Thank you.
What's the impact on U.S. efforts to achieve a degree of normalcy in Iraq? Were this to become the new modus operandi, that every time you get $7 million a day worth of oil flowing, you just blow up a pipeline and that's the end of that?
U.S. officials are obviously frustrated with the trouble they're having in getting the infrastructure back up to speed, and the sabotage doesn't help it at all. I think Iraqi officials you're hearing more often express frustration that the military is not able to protect these installations better. The oil minister a couple of days ago was very explicit about it, saying that in the days of Saddam Hussein, you had a multi-layered security force along with tribes in these areas that were going to keep an eye on things such as the oil pipeline. Obviously, that system has collapsed. U.S. officials, since they're doing their best at it, they've put what they say are 5,500 guards at these installations. A contract went out 10 days ago for another 6,500 people to keep an eye on these installations. But there's a lot out there. The pipeline itself runs, I think, 500 or 600 miles.
Now, mightn't this cut another way, Anthony? It must infuriate Iraqis to know that presumably fellow Iraqis are preventing them from getting water, making money from oil, on and on.
Well, you see an interesting dynamic out there. I was at the water main that was ruptured yesterday, and I asked a person who he blamed, and he said he blamed both Saddam and the Americans. I think on the one hand, you do see people very, resentful over these attacks and that it's making their lives, very much more difficult. But I think there's also kind of resentment of U.S. forces that, they're not able to protect the infrastructure, that they're the occupying force here and that it's their responsibility to provide security.
Anthony, just to finish up, let's shift focus for a moment. Tragic story. A Reuters cameraman filming a U.S. tank. The U.S. tank apparently thought he was firing a rocket-propelled grenade and fired and killed him. What can you tell us about that incident?
Well, U.S. officials have said the shooting's under investigation, and a spokesman at a briefing today suggested that if the investigation shows that changes need to be made in the so-called rules of engagement, those changes will be made. The shooting of the Reuters journalist comes after a series of incidents in which civilians have been killed and two policemen as well by U.S. soldiers. And there's some criticism in among Iraqis that soldiers are perhaps too quick to fire, particularly at military checkpoints that dot the capital. The shooting of the Reuters journalist was especially tragic. It was in broad daylight. He was standing on a bridge. It was not secluded. And soldiers apparently mistook his camera for a rocket-propelled grenade. All the witnesses in the area said it was clear that he was carrying a camera.
What does it tell you, though, about how soldiers feel in Iraq right now?
People are obviously very jittery here, and the attacks are not decreasing on U.S. soldiers. There's, the average about 12 a day across the country. If anything, they may be increased by one or so a day on average.
Anthony Shadid, thank you, as always, for joining us on Here and Now.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid, Washington Post correspondent, joined us from Baghdad.
The Pentagon is bristling at reports that American troops may be getting shortchanged when it comes to their paychecks. The Defense Department says that it is rolling back pay raises to more than 150,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan when the fiscal year ends next month, but that it will not reduce the soldiers' total pay. For some families, that would have amounted to a loss of $225 a month in imminent danger and family separation pay. The Defense Department says troops will receive other forms of pay raises to make up for the loss. Joining me on the line is Army Times managing editor Chuck Vince. And Chuck, are you surprised by the fact that they were even considering cutbacks in both imminent danger and separation pay? Because certainly this is an administration that has talked a lot about supporting the troops.
Yes, I was a little bit. In fact, they do have a pretty good record since the Bush administration took office. They have continued the targeted pay raises for mid-level enlisted people that the Clinton administration began. But it seems like lately they've been taking some low-level pay and benefits issues and shortchanging the troops a little bit. This certainly jumped out as one of them. What happened was in April, the Pentagon boosted what they call imminent danger pay and family separation allowance as part of the Iraq supplemental funding bill that was approved in April. But Congress inserted what they call a sunset provision in there under which those higher rates would expire at the end of the fiscal year.
And were those supposed to end at that point,
do you think,
because Congress assumed that the troops would be home by then?
No, it was just basically they put that sunset provision in there to win swift approval of that increase in the two pays, or the cutoff protracted debate. I think the idea was we'll revisit it when we deal with the 2004 budget. Just last Wednesday, the Pentagon announced out of the blue, they say they've been working on this plan for a while, but this announcement came out of the blue that they will not cut the net pay of anyone in Iraq and Afghanistan. They don't want to maintain the higher rates of danger pay and family allowance, but they will use their other special pays to make the overall net income of those troops the same into the new fiscal year.
And do you buy that? I mean, do you think that the troops are going to wind up with the same amount of pay as they would have had?
The timing of the announcement is a little curious to me. I mean, if you're at all cynical, and most journalists are, they say they've been working on this plan for a while, but we cover military pay and benefits, one of our bread and butter issues, and we haven't heard a word about it. It's kind of curious that the announcement comes out just as the crescendo of criticism is peaking over this issue. But I'm reasonably hopeful now that, at least for the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, we won't see any cut in pay. However, the Pentagon's referred specifically and repeatedly to troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, there are troops all around the Persian Gulf region, troops on ships in the Persian Gulf, which is not exactly a very safe place, troops in Kuwait, troops in Kazakhstan and other places around Central Asia that are not exactly settled places. Under the Pentagon plan, at least, they would not get these higher rates of pay.
Well, certainly all the Democrats running for president were very critical about this.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's a good issue to bash the Republicans on. But, you know, this isn't a partisan issue, really. Republicans and Democrats can be equally clueless about military pay and benefits and how important they can be.
Well, Chuck, we know what the Democratic presidential candidates have been saying about it. What was the reaction among the troops and their families when word first came that these pay increases were going to be rolled back?
Well, just about what you expected. They were very, very upset. You know, that if the Pentagon had wanted to head this off, if they've been working on this plan for a while, they certainly could have put out word that they had something in the works a lot earlier than this and saved everyone a little angst. For a junior enlisted person, that $225 a month could be as much as 15% of their take-home pay.
Exactly.
So it's no small amount.
I was going to say, particularly for these young military families, that's a significant amount of money for them.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, Chuck, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Chuck Vince is managing editor of the Army Times.
Still to come, classical music doesn't need to be heard on just violins and pianos. What about the banjo?
You're listening to Here and Now.
Robin Young is on vacation today, but before she left, she filed this report.
Scientists are collecting data on 29,000 rubber duckies and other bathroom toys that fell off a container ship in the Pacific Ocean in 1992 and are now reported to be following the Earth's currents through the Bering Strait, around Greenland, and down to New England.
Are you on the lookout for the rubber duckies?
The yellow ones that came out of a container ship.
You've heard about them?
Yes, I have.
And are you looking for them?
Yeah.
Have you seen the rubber duckies?
Not as of yet, but I am looking.
You are?
Yes, I am. I want the grant. Are they giving away a bond, I think, the company that owns the rubber duckies? If you retrieve a rubber ducky and give it back to them, they give you a $200 savings bond, I think.
I think it's only $100, but still.
Only $100? Oh, I'll keep the ducky on my mantle then.
I have no doubt that some of them are there. It's just that there's something like 1,400 different kinds of yellow ducks floating around, so beachcombers get them confused with the other species.
Retired oceanographer Kurt Ebbesmeyer, the informal global dean of beachcombers, he lets them know if they found the right ducky.
It has "the first years" written on its little chest. It's about an inch high, and by now it will have faded from yellow to white. So we're looking for white ducks.
Through his website, Ebbesmeyer tracks what he calls drifters, everything from plastic credit cards to Nike sneakers.
Yeah, we had about every year Nike loses container loads of shoes into the ocean, along with many other manufacturers. And the most recent spill is 33,000 Nike shoes lost off California, and they're heading north to Alaska, moving about 400 miles a month. Mm. The ocean moves things around for great distances, and trash released off one continent goes to the other continent. Something like up to 30% of the trash in Western Britain comes from North America, and Florida gets a lot of trash from South America. So it just doesn't go away. It just goes to somebody else's front yard.
And especially if it's plastic. A lot of scientists are concerned that plastics aren't only destroying the food chain. One scientist found 6 pounds of plastic for every one of plankton in a certain area in the Pacific. But they also add estrogen to the ocean, which is a concern. And it's kind of messy. Besides tracking ocean currents and raising concerns about plastics in the ocean, is there anything else we can learn from these duckies?
The new thing we've learned is that the ducks are moving twice as fast as surface water, which means they can literally go around the planet in 10 years. I used to think that it was something like 20 or 30 years, but these are kind of hyper speedsters, and we're getting getting an idea that trash can move pretty fast.
Right. Is there something also about, you know, these are resilient little guys. You know, they're kind of heroic.
Yeah, they really are. If I could ride on the back of a duck and see all the places that they've gone, it would be truly marvelous.
Oceanographer Curtis Ebbesmeyer. You can find out about his website at oursherenow.org. Well, not everyone I talked to at sea shared our feelings for the duckies. You know, there's something...
Well, are they migratory duckies? Are these rubber duckies going to be taking jobs away from East Coast rubber duckies? I mean, that's, you know, that's the real question here.
Am I the only one who thinks that there's something kind of noble about these guys? 11 years out on the sea.
You're reaching.
Okay, all right.
It's not exactly, I mean, old man in the sea, duck, you know, rubber ducky.
All right.
Oh, rubber ducky, you're the one. You make bath time lots of fun.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Dale Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
That's the Badinerie movement from Bach's Orchestral Suite No. 2, played by the Academy of Ancient Music. And that, too, was Bach's Badinerie, but in a very unusual guise. It's from Lara St. John's new CD, Re-Bach. Well, whatever you might think of the new arrangement, it's nothing more than a transcription. And for better or worse, composers and arrangers have been making transcriptions for hundreds of years. In fact, Bach himself was a frequent transcriber and transcribee. Well, joining me in the studio to talk about old wine in new bottles is Here and Now's classical music connoisseur, Ellen Pfeiffer. Welcome, Ellen.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Ellen, first of all, what exactly is a transcription?
Well, basically, it involves taking a pre-existing work or tune and arranging it for another medium, violin to piano, string quartet to chamber orchestra, piano to full orchestra. Often the process involves changing the key, reworking some of the material to better suit the new instrument. In really elaborate transcriptions or paraphrasers, the arranger may create variations on the original material or use the original as a springboard for virtuoso elaboration, like Franz Liszt in his many piano paraphrases of operatic music.
Well, what about what we just heard, those two versions, very divergent indeed, of Bach's Orchestral Suite No. 2? Do they fit in with the tradition of
this?
Well,
they do, although I must say I think it's another illustration of the dismal depths that we have fallen to these days.
Depending on, you know.
But, and in fact, I think a lot of the crossover music that you hear is this kind of thing where you take a piece that has an ancient tradition and put a rock rhythm track to it. Or, as they've done in other parts of this recording, they've turned it into New Age. They've done a sort of Celtic step dance version. They've done an Indian raga kind of version.
And that's just too gimmicky for you.
Too gimmicky, yeah. Mm.
Bach was a big proponent himself, though, of transcription.
He was, and a very gifted one. He did a lot of transcriptions of Vivaldi's music. Vivaldi was much more famous than he was at the time and a real, you know, sort of the leading proponent of Italian style. So Bach did a lot of transcriptions of Vivaldi music. The most famous one, which we're going to listen to, is He took Vivaldi's concerto for four violins and turned it into a concerto for four harpsichords, which he and his sons played in Zimmermann's coffee house during one of their Collegium Musicum evenings.
Well, genius, transcribing genius there, Bach transcribing Vivaldi. What for you, I think we've got a little hint already, means a good transcription as opposed to a bad one?
Fundamentally, it has to be an arrangement that reflects the respect and love and admiration of the arranger for the original piece. And Arnold Schoenberg did a wonderful arrangement of the Brahms G minor piano quartet. And he talked about how when doing it, he didn't change anything about the style that Brahms would have used. And his basic idea behind it was he wanted to be able to hear all the parts. He said that when the chamber piece was played as a chamber piece, if the pianist was any good, he would be too loud and would drown out the strings. And he wrote that for once he wanted to hear all the parts, and so he set it for orchestra and did a marvelous job.
And they're a great modernist transcribing a great romantic.
Yes.
Couldn't be more different composers in some ways. Let's listen to a transcription that I think you feel didn't work out all that well.
It's not terrible, but it's a little bizarre. It's Bela Fleck performing a Scarlatti keyboard sonata on banjo, and then there's a mandolin part as well.
Gee, I kind of like that, almost a lute-like sound he's getting out of it.
Yes, and in fact, the keyboard, the early keyboard and the lute were not too dissimilar.
You know, Ellen, one of the most famous transcriptions of all that I know of is Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, which began as a piano piece.
That's correct. And a lot of composers and arrangers made transcriptions of works to put them in playable versions. And that's probably one of the most famous. Of course, we know the Ravel orchestration best of all. But amazingly enough, 20 other arrangers have also done performing versions of that piece. And there's an interesting recording. It's a big compendium of the St. Louis Symphony under Leonard Slatkin. And he does the whole piece, but each section with a different arranger. And then he has some commentary about it. It's very interesting.
I'd love to hear that. That's a selection from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, transcribed by Sergei Gorchakov. And Ellen, wasn't Franz Liszt another frequent transcriber?
Oh, yes. And he was famous for his operatic paraphrases and would take the hit tunes of the latest opera and weave them together in a piano fantasy that would, of course, celebrate his own virtuosity as well as the original music. Here's a kind of an interesting one. It's a transcription of the Tannhäuser Overture by Wagner. And it's a whole orchestra reduced to a piano, but it sounds like it needs about five hands to play it.
Liszt may be showing off there a little of his keyboard mastery, as he liked to do. How about one more, Ellen? Shall we listen to... What have you got?
This is Gustav Mahler's arrangement for chamber orchestra of Franz Schubert's great string quartet, Death and the Maiden. And I think it's another example of very good taste, exquisite taste, being applied to a new medium.
Schubert's original, of course, a string quartet.
That's correct. And this expanded into a chamber orchestra, all strings, and, you know, achieving a certain richness and plushness that perhaps was not, you would not hear in the original.
And a Mahler-esqueness.
I think a lot of transcriptions reflect the periods in which they're done.
The
levels of taste.
Perhaps the composer that does them.
And the composer, of course, that does them.
Well, Ellen Pfeiffer, as always, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Joining us. Ellen Pfeiffer is here and now's classical music connoisseur. For a list of the music we played, please check out our website at here-now.org. Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Stefano Katsonis, and Jordana Gustafson. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
The inquiry into the death of British weapons expert.
Here and now.
The inquiry into the death of British weapons expert.